You're listening to the Body Pros podcast coverage of CROI 2008, the 15th Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections. The conference took place in Boston, Massachusetts from February 3rd through February 6th, 2008.
Welcome. This is Bonnie Goldman, Editorial Director of the Body Pro. Right now, I'm in the poster session where researchers are standing in front of their posters. There's nothing like hearing the results of research directly from those who have actually conducted the research. It is these women and men who are transforming HIV treatment and care. In this podcast, the researchers will introduce themselves and then summarize their study. After their summary, I'll ask a few questions. Accompanying me on this interview is Dr. Gerald Perrone, a clinician and researcher who is the director of the AIDS Research and Treatment Center of the Treasure Coast in Fort Pierce, Florida.
I'm Daniel Fearer. I'm an infectious diseases physician at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in Manhattan. And my presentation is discussing really an accelerated liver fibrosis, an outbreak of HIV, acute hepatitis C in HIV-infected men. And what we've observed is really something that had not been described, which is that it is part of the epidemic of acute HCV. We did liver biopsies very early in the course. These were otherwise pretty healthy men who had very well-controlled HIV infection in many cases and would be considered to be very well-controlled and careful with their health. But many were having unprotected sex with other HIV-infected men and presented to the practitioners with really classic acute hepatitis C, a new increase in liver enzymes and a new antibody to hepatitis C. And they came then to me, and within the first month after their hepatitis, in some cases, biopsy showed a stage 2 out of 4 fibrosis. Now, that was has been really an unprecedented finding, because in other studies of acute hepatitis C in people who don't have HIV infection, it would be extremely rare to find any fibrosis at all. In an Egyptian study of over 80 patients with acute hepatitis C biopsied early, none of them had any fibrosis. And in a much smaller group in Italy of people who had been infected by an unfortunate contamination when they were in a clinical trial, of 9 patients, only 4 had stage 1 fibrosis early on. And so this was completely unexpected. In the outbreaks, nobody has done any systematic liver biopsies, expecting probably to find nothing. And we found stage 2 out of 4 pretty much uniformly. I'm presenting here 11 patients. 9 of them had stage 2, 1 of them had stage 1, and 1 had a different flavor of liver disease, but it is not necessarily characteristic of hepatitis C. It's a little controversy between our hepatologists, but a fairly monotonic, significant fibrosis in fairly healthy people who didn't have any other reason to have underlying liver disease.
So what do you think?
So I think that the unifying thing in this, and going back in the literature and looking at what was happening, is that underlying immunosuppression in general is a very bad thing set up for liver disease and hepatitis C. HIV may be particularly at risk. So we have a slightly disingenuous figure here where it looks at fibrosis progression rate units per year, from 0 to 4, and that here the rate of chronic hepatitis C in HIV-infected people of 0.15 units per year. Okay, these are 2 units, and that's considered much faster. That's the much higher rate than 0.11 units, and that, you know, it's 40% faster maybe. If you have underlying immunosuppression of some sort, schistosomiasis in Egypt causes a rapidly accelerated hepatitis C at a much higher rate. It's 4 times higher. And coming here to people who have liver transplants who had hepatitis C and majorly immunosuppressive drugs, if they do protocol biopsies in a year, they can have stage 1 fibrosis in a year. In contrast, our patients, that's why it's slightly disingenuous, because we biopsied them very early and haven't followed them for a long time yet, because we're not going to, we're going to treat them, had, if you sort of average this out by the time that to biopsy, a fibrosis progression rate of 4, of over 4. Now, that's not completely accurate because 4 is cirrhosis, and that's at a year. And we know we can biopsy people at a year. But I think the reason I have this here is to show that people say, accelerated fibrosis in HIV, and think, oh, we know that. Say, but this is actually much different.
How do you know, there are emerging reports of patients with long-term exposure to HIV medications having fibrosis based on drug. How do you know you're just not picking up that this person, if you pull them off the street without Hep C and biopsy them, wouldn't have stage 2
question.
Disease?
Well, the short answer is we have one patient, our poster child here, who's never received antiretrovirals. A couple here, he had less than a year, and not the D drugs, which we usually think of as the things that are responsible for that. And while some people have had antiretrovirals for 14 or 16 years, some of them, as I said, never, less than a year, 3 years, 5 years. And those studies, they're very few and far between. We've looked for all of them that showed, suggested fibrosis in people who took antiretrovirals. Actually biopsied a very small number of people who had ALT elevation, and they didn't see, from what we can tell, things that would be considered to be hepatitis C classic fibrosis, although we haven't seen those biopsies ourselves. So they were a very select group of hundreds of people screened, and they weren't all found to have something that looked like stage 2 fibrosis, indistinguishable from chronic. Stage 2 only refers to chronic hepatitis C.
Along those lines, did many of your patients have much in the way of steatohepatitis in conjunction with?
Really good question. So there are some, but not of the kind that usually is seen with antiretrovirals. So the main toxicities you're alluding to of antiretrovirals, usually what you see on biopsy is steatohepatitis without significant fibrosis. It looks a little more like the non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, which we do know leads to fibrosis, and it can be periportal fibrosis, and people get cirrhosis, liver failure, need liver transplants for NASH, non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. One of our patients might have had something sort of looking like that, but he was the one who was infected only less than a year and was on very few and short duration antiretrovirals. Mm-hmm. So we don't know quite what was going on in him, and I'm hoping to get another follow-up liver biopsy on some of these people. We've asked them after treatment to see what happens. But I think we can state very confidently that this is not the antiretrovirals. I think even a single person who we have who never saw them, antiretrovirals, I think would disprove it, because we have such a clear monotonic stage 2, 9 out of 11 with stage 2 fibrosis. And there is that fine. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to back up and talk about the infections, because I think this is the first time in the United States where MSM has been described to have HCV transmitted to them, because the other studies were, or the descriptions were, in Europe. Is that correct?
So I have to give credit to Annie Lukemeyer and her colleagues at UCSF, who described a retrospective study of, as I remember, 9 patients in JAIDS the end of 2006. And they remarked that going back to the chart and talking to the people, that some of those people clearly were not injection drug users and believed that that may have been sexual transmission. But having said that, this is a prospective cohort that I'm collecting, very much like the European experience. And so I think we are, I'm personally going out and waving my arms in the community and asking for people to refer their patients to me.
This is in New York, right? And could you talk about their exposures?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a very detailed questionnaire that's derived from Mark Dantas, actually, from London. I asked my patients, actually, to help me modify it to be relevant to New York, the right websites and such about where I'm visiting. And our results have been fairly similar to what was reported in England and also in Holland, who had the most detailed questionnaire things, where most of the men had unprotected anal intercourse and a fair number of what would be considered high risk, possibly for some trauma, appears to be not very much at risk for injection or percutaneous. So having said that, although our numbers are somewhat smaller, about 25, I'm presenting 11 here with liver biopsies, a few of them have, due to, I think, a fairly mature crystal meth epidemic, have been slamming, and
Could you describe what slamming is?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry.
The lingo. So injecting crystal meth and in particular. And that there have been long-time crystal meth users swallowing and snorting and had become very recently interested in trying injection use of it. And a couple people, one person did tell me that he had been pretty sure that he had shared his works with somebody else. The others really said they've been very careful to not do it, but being that high, just simply couldn't remember. So it's the minority of the group. It's more percentage-wise than was reported in Europe, and I think that may represent different crystal meth use, and patients certainly telling me that they've seen quite a number of people who injected in the clubs. There are people who are going and injecting people as a service, and so there is a fair amount of it around, and I think that speaks to a very significant concern that this hepatitis C outbreak could really spiral because hepatitis C is much more infectious through the blood route. And if that is a sure way to introduce in a big way hepatitis C into this group of men who really hadn't had much hepatitis C, I think, relative to other populations, which I think is one of the reasons why it was relatively rare in the past. But I think we may be reaching, and I hesitate to use the word threshold from a pure epidemiology standpoint, but in a more layperson's way of saying it, a threshold at which point this may amplify significantly because there will be just a core amount of hepatitis C in the group of people at risk and then allow that to maybe spiral. Yes.
I see some of the exposures might have been straws. Could you talk about that also from a prevention point of view?
Right.
People don't realize that using a straw might be dangerous.
Well, there is a significant amount of use in the cocaine field and the suggestion that straws have been, virus has been isolated from straws that have been used in usually a minority of cases, but it's felt to be and it's listed as a risk factor for transmission of hepatitis C. So we list any possible exposures as a possibility. In reality, most also who shared straws had unprotected sex with many men, and so we don't know that it was a straw, but again, to list the possible route, because I think people are quite skeptical in this country because we haven't been talking about outbreaks of acute hepatitis C as a sexually transmitted thing, and people ask me, how do you know it wasn't, it's just the injection thing? I said, no, here's the most conservative look. This person told me that they shared a straw a couple of times. That's the sum total of the exposure. And so that's what I listed. But it certainly has been considered to be, and especially associated with cocaine use, and I don't see why crystal meth would actually be different. It's a pretty abrasive substance, why that could be a risk factor.
You mentioned before that you're going to be treating these, or you've treated these patients. Any of them, did you follow them to see what percentage would actually clear the virus on their own? And so my question
yes.
is, perhaps could we be seeing a phenomenon where some of these patients might clear virus on their own and also clear fibrosis on their own as in a treated patient?
So to me, I'm going to treat them as really separate questions, but I think a very important point about clearing on their own. It's something I'm very interested in following, and that thinking has evolved in the European different groups, where the English clearly watch to see for clearance, and initially the German group hadn't been, and they saw the English data and started observing. So 12 weeks is kind of what people are writing down now as an observation period of after clinical time. So backing up for a second, the definition that's in the books of what acute hepatitis C is, it was simply defined as the first 6 months of infection, starting from the time you're infected. Well, we can't really identify the type of infection. That's fine in a transfusion experience, you know, in the initial days, but we really can't know that. Having said that, I think that that was a fairly arbitrary distinction that was brought down, really extrapolated from the hepatitis B experience. I mean, hepatitis C is a fairly newly described, it's a very newly described virus. And so we transferred this idea of acute period. Well, hepatitis B, 95% of people clear, and they do it very quickly if they're going to do it. Hepatitis C is clearly different than that. And so I think that the acute phase of hepatitis C, it's controversial and how long it takes people to clear. And if you look at different cohorts, they're very different answers. Some people insist that everybody who's going to clears in 3 months. And some people have shown in an Australian cohort shown that up to 2 years, a significant number of people are still clearing in 2 years. So based on that experience and with the nervousness that underlying HIV infection may change things, I have been really individualizing and watching patients very closely for things that come along with acute HCV infection, which include fluctuations in viral load and LFTs. And so while I some people look like they're going to clear very early, and the question, absolutely, I give people a chance to clear in at least 12 weeks, but sometimes up to 24 weeks from their first ALT elevation, which technically speaking would be longer than 24 weeks, longer than 6 months after their first infection, because it takes a couple of months or so for the ALT elevation. But there are people who have wide fluctuations and down very low, their viral load goes down quite low. I want to give those people a chance because I think that immunologically, they do much better. If they clear on their own, that's much better, not to mention not having to get 6 months of interferon
retroviral. Did any of these 11 clear?
So I have a pretty strict definition of that because I have to wait at least 6 months to give them sort of the SVR definition, at least 6 months of undetectable viral load. So we have three people who are basically there. This is a pretty new... I've really just started recruiting this cohort only about a year and a half ago after about... plus or minus, with our first couple of people came in. And so I haven't had time as much as the Europeans to observe them. But, yes, they're we have somewhere at least 15% rate right now who look like they're going to clear. Others, we've started treatment. We've had really excellent success so far. Nobody whom we've initiated treatment on has failed yet. Knock on wood, but we're talking about seven or so people right now who've made it far enough to really assess to end of treatment. So I've, as I said, I have about 25 patients who we've seen, but considering the observation period and the length of treatment and then the 6 months afterwards, I don't have long-term data on many. But we are optimistic that despite this observation of stage 2 fibrosis, that they are behaving as acute HCV, and that it was a very high rate. They're all genotype 1, and so very high rate of clearance.
Had you done any FIB4 or FibroSures or anything to try to link to this, or no?
So I've looked, done a couple of the calculations. We haven't done anything that involved other serum markers, so just the basic laboratory things that you can calculate. And it is too early that I think most people would acknowledge that stage 2, while being very significant, if you have it within a month of your HCV infection, is not far enough advanced to see on the non-invasive tests. So it's really silent to me.
Why not?
Well, I think the non-invasive tests are pretty much acknowledged to only pick up things at about stage 3 and stage 4. They're pretty good at distinguishing cirrhosis, and then possibly stage 3, but there's just not enough. Those require systemic changes.
When you look at the receiver operating curves, though, they seem pretty uniform. I mean, they seem to perform.
They perform well, but not at stage 2. They just can't predict the earlier stages. The same thing. We're interested in FibroScan and obtaining a FibroScan. We've been working on the funding for that. We're interested to see that. I think that, again, the... to get the sensitivity there, the specificity isn't good, and I think the Spaniards have a lot of experience, and they were this meeting reporting about that. I have not seen their actual data on that, but we'd be very interested to be able to find it other ways. I'm really interested in trying to understand what is driving the fibrosis, and the liver biopsy is really, unfortunately, in that sense, because it's invasive, the only way we're going to be able to identify other things, and our pathologists have been looking very carefully at other things. This is focused on the periportal fibrosis, but on other elements that may give us clues as to what other inflammatory processes may be going on, and those will not be revealed. It would be nice to have non-invasive markers to be able to follow people over time to see how they will do, and unfortunately I don't think we're going to be able to do that either on this, but in order to really discover what we have as the pathogenesis,
that would be
we
ideal.
Do need the
you
liver tissue.
What to do, FibroSures, FibroScans, link it with your biopsy, and then
right.
Once you have a little bit of a database, then you might be able to
right.
Sort things out.
And we plan to do that. But unfortunately, from fairly large experience in people with chronic hepatitis C, we don't expect to have good results of that, because at least in people with chronic hepatitis C, that's flying below. Stage 2 is really flying below the radar, but that would be very helpful.
I have a final question about the HCV transmission. I
yes.
noticed that most of the men are older.
Yes.
What's your feeling about that? I don't know if that's duplicated in the other reports about there's not a man in his 20s.
That's true.
The average age is probably 42
yeah.
or something.
Yeah.
So that's kind of striking. And what do you make of that?
There are a couple of observations in there that I find distressing as well. So some of these men in their 40s have had HIV infection for some time. Some of them, however, were very recently HIV infected. So our poster child with liver biopsy had only become HIV infected and had regular tests only a year prior, 11 months prior. I have a number of people who are still enrolled in the acute HIV cohort studies. So not only were they newly infected, but we have documentation and they were involved in a clinical trial, therefore very aware of issues and risk factors, all the more reinforcing how they didn't think that this was a sexually transmitted thing, because here they are involved in these cohorts. Aaron Diamond, also, but I'm starting to enroll an incredible proportion of them, and I'm talking to them. We're kind of looking into how we can look at this together. So these are actually people who made it into their 40s without getting HIV infected, people who, in fact, had been having sex for some years. It wasn't a new thing. So I'm not sure exactly, but it is distressing that men in their 40s who have lived through the HIV epidemic and watched their friends die, and now some of them becoming recently HIV infected and now hepatitis C infected. And it's certainly much worse for their liver that getting hepatitis C at 40, oh, I don't think of that as somebody in his mid to late 40s. I don't consider that to be particularly old, but it is definitely doesn't help progression in hepatitis C either.
Do you think methamphetamine may have played a role at all in fibrosis? Is there any literature on methamphetamine effects on liver?
So methamphetamine in large doses can cause a fulminant hepatic failure. It's been reported in a couple of times, and it's been pointed out. However, many drugs cause fulminant hepatic failure, and there's nothing reported that I found, and I've really looked in, including the human and animal toxicology literature, that showed that long-time exposure can cause actual fibrosis, periportal fibrosis. I think it's something that's been considered. Actually, there's a little more evidence for marijuana being a problem, interestingly enough, than methamphetamine. And so that is something we're starting to look into, something that we all consider pretty benign drug, but interested in liver fibrosis and marijuana use. So I don't think that, again, that the drug use is what is going on here. In fact, I'm going to state definitively that it's not, because many of these men never used drugs at all, club drugs. At first, our first few were all pretty big drug users, but then we had a run, so to speak, of people who didn't use any drugs. And I think they're pretty clear about it. They're really pretty straightforward about their sexual risks and other things, and I think that they're everyone always says, how do you know? They're just not telling you. There's a long history of docs not believing patients, and I think that, well, if it were one person, and I would stake my toe and say, okay, maybe one person's telling me a story, but I've had enough people I talk to, and they've been very frank about other parts of their lives and sex lives, I believe that they're not trying to avoid telling me that they use Crystal when they don't use anything. So I'm pretty confident about that.
Huh. Well, thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome.
Really interesting.
I hope this gets out. I mean, this is pretty much to the man that come in and say, I'm not a heroin addict. How did I get this just shock and horror? No sense. It's like, nobody knows this is a risk, We don't know, everyone needs to know. And it's, I think it's really important. One of the things I hope is get the word out to the guys that this is, they're serosorting. And so say, what can I get? Syphilis, I've had it. I can get that treated. Most things. But Hep C is not on the radar screen, and it's clearly, and it's very scary. They're very freaked out by the time they see me. I've been all over the internet, and look at the terrible things that happen. So I think the awareness of the community is nil that it can happen. It's not super common, but it could get that way. The more people that get it, it spirals, I think. And once it's introduced into a community at risk, and the risk factors continue, the risk activities continue, it's going to get worse. And so it's bad enough, but then with the underlying fibrosis, the risk of not getting treated, I think, is enormous. Even getting treated, it doesn't necessarily know that we can prevent worsening. We hope we can, but But this is asymptomatic in 80% of people. These are people diligently screening. I see one of them behind me, Dr. Akil, who diligently screen their patients for ALT, asymptomatic ALT elevations, and the suspicion has to be high. The risk of missing people with this, I think, is very, very significant.
Many clinicians do not have it on their radar of something to test.
That's right. That's right.
For someone.
And I think we have some very smart docs in New York, and they're educating the others. And I think with this, I'm hoping to be a part of that and encourage people to at least screen ALT every 3 months and a hep C antibody every year, which is not currently recommended in this group of men who were not considered at risk for acute hepatitis C. So I think we should absolutely start doing this. This is something that can be transmitted sexually in some way. We don't know exactly how that is, but involved with sex that isn't involved with traditional lots of percutaneous exposure. And I think we need to change how we think about that and educate the community and educate docs to be on the lookout for it. And think even any sexually transmitted infection to test for hep C, and then you have to test and follow it because it'll be a delayed. It'll be 2 months delayed. And think about it, or we'll miss it, and I think the risks of missing it are really significant. And you also miss the real great benefit of early treatment because it's so much more effective.
Good. Well, thank you.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
This has been a report on CROI 2008 from The Body Pro. For more podcasts and full coverage of this conference, visit us online at thebodypro.com/CROI2008.